It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A time when the questions are more important than the answers, when vulnerability is much more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this.
My name is Carolyn Grimminger. I'm a member of Worship Associates, and I've also been a member of this church for about 2 years. By day, I'm an adult probation officer. I'm very excited to be able to share with you my passion for helping people on probation reintegrate into society. I have been an adult probation officer in Travis County for 7 years. I'm also a licensed chemical dependency counselor and a social worker. I love my work, and I find it very meaningful and challenging. The mission statement of our department is to protect the community and to rehabilitate the offender. Most of the people on my specialized substance abuse caseload are on felony probation for such offenses as possession of a controlled substance, felony drunk driving, and assaults committed while under the influence of alcohol or illegal drugs. Most of the people on my caseload have been diagnosed with chemical dependency. Many are also what's called dually diagnosed, which means they suffer from a mental illness such as clinical depression or manic depression coupled with chemical dependency. I would like to be able to say that I'm working my way out of a job. I would also like to say that our efforts at probation are enabling people to leave the system and either return to productive lives or start productive lives. However, on dark days, it just seems there's an endless conveyor belt of people coming at me with ingrained patterns of thinking that lead to destructive behavior and damaged lives. As a society, what do we accomplish by incarcerating these people? Are we trying to change people or simply keep them out of our sight? And if they're out of our sight, are we safe from them? What about when they are released back to our community? Access to chemical dependency and mental health treatment is shrinking. With more and more people losing access to health insurance, those who suffer from the diseases of addiction and mental illness have less access to needed treatment and medication. More and more individuals in our community are going without treatment, and it appears that they are getting sicker and sicker. Many who get involved in the justice system are people who have progressed in their illnesses. Maybe this progression could have been mitigated with effective intervention and treatment. With fewer and fewer resources and a drying up of creativity, imagination, and compassion, jails and prisons appear to be becoming the receptacles for addicts, alcoholics, and the mentally ill. Mental illness and chemical dependency are public health issues, not moral deviancies that are cured in response to punishment. In the past couple of years, I have noticed that the people on my caseload are exhibiting more violent behaviors stemming from deeper psychological and sociological problems. With the budget crisis of last year, our caseloads are getting larger and larger, and we are expected to do more with lower quality and fewer treatment beds for non-insured people. It is a challenge of compassion to be a person of liberal religious belief, a person who is challenged in her faith to believe that people are innately good when I witness horrendous behavior. How do I feel about giving up on people and having them incarcerated in a system where they will be further dehumanized and damaged? Does prison cure people? Is punishment rehabilitating? When people are released, are they ready to be law-abiding citizens, or are they even more damaged than before they were incarcerated? Do they present even more of a risk to our community than before they were imprisoned? I have conducted an aftercare group on Tuesday nights for the past 6 years. One of the chief goals of the group is to provide tools to enable the clients to become citizens and to give something back to the community. Many of the people that attend the group do not exhibit social skills or commendable values. When they rebel against me and it becomes apparent that they have been manipulating me for months, that they have not changed their thinking or behaviors, do I continue to follow the principles that I know are effective in helping people to change by having the patience for slow, steady, compassionate support that lasting attitudinal and behavior change requires? Or Do I resort to threats and take consolation in the short-term, ego-driven payoff that I have the power to lock them up? Do I try to become more effective in my efforts to rehabilitate? What centers me is to stay focused on the fact that even if they do get locked up, they will eventually re-enter society. And I ask myself, what tools will they have? People are not just things we throw away, give up on, and get out of our sight. Incarcerated people are still someone's child, parent, friend, coworker. They deserve more from us. They could become us. I'm called upon every day to be a rational authority with irrational people in an irrational system. I've often aspired to the statement attributed to the Old Testament prophet Micah, that the three things that are required of us are to live justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. A big part of my work is asking myself, am I living up to that charge?
Now at the center of our service and the center of our lives, let us take time to honor the quieter moments in life. You may take these first few moments to light candles of memory and hope, or just to sit quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in an attitude of prayer. We give thanks today for our freedom. We have so much to be thankful for the right to vote, for the right to practice our religious faith in safety without fear, for the right to due process. These are things we get to take for granted. For the freedom to move about the country without checkpoints, or the more esoteric freedom to follow the call of our free will and change our lives, adjust the ways we live as we find the courage to. We are thankful for these privileges and mindful that freedom remains relative, even in a country as great as this one. Today we admit to ourselves that our freedoms are relative to our status, whether we have grown up with advantages or not, whether or not we have been nurtured in an environment that tells us we are destined to succeed and may choose our path, whether we are male or female, whether our sexual identity is acceptable or not, whether our skin color is favorable, and especially whether we are affluent or poor. We cannot deny that certain factors enhance our abilities to take advantage of our freedom and put it to good use. May our sense of entitlement be healthy and balanced. May we use our freedom to serve the world more than consume it. May we remember that the deepest patriotism is willing to serve our country, whether abroad or at home. May we remember that the deepest patriotism is the willingness to work for a better country, to have the courage to admit to our mistakes, to acknowledge the places where we are broken and desperately need repair and reform. May we use our freedom and patriotic duty to improve the standards of justice and equality in our country. May we learn from the past and make it possible for all of us to contribute, even if we have made mistakes. Amen. Thank you for coming to church on this holiday. Happy 4th of July. Happy Independence Day. Today I'm going to talk about those whose independence has been lost, those who are not free. Talking about the criminal justice system immediately focuses attention on some very difficult and harsh realities. No, this cannot be a feel-good sermon, which is a lot more fun to deliver and a lot more comforting to receive. A phrase I heard a lot in seminary was that we need to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. But there's a high degree of self-righteousness in that statement that doesn't serve anyone. For the fact is, we are all afflicted. Michel Foucault, the French social philosopher, summed up well the main message I want to deliver today, that when there are this many people on the inside, in prison, then no one is on the outside. At the heart of this topic is a deep well of sadness that I think we all share, that has to do with the frustrations about the way people are used and treated in our modern society. Because at the heart of Foucault's statement is a spiritual truth about humanity, that we are all connected, regardless of race or class, and that what happens to others also happens to us on a deep level of our consciousness that is difficult to define. Our separateness is an illusion. As more and more people are damaged in the prison system, our society as one body also becomes more troubled. I want to make clear that none of this is anyone's fault. Lately, I have taken to a very deep doubt and suspicion of political correctness and its accessories. I refuse to heap liberal guilt upon anyone here this morning, or to shake my finger at any ignorance that all of us share to one degree or another. The purpose of talking about the criminal justice system is because it is a system that needs to be changed, because it hurts everyone, especially so many of those caught up in it. And there is actually hope of it changing, because even policymakers are waking up to the consequences of their mistaken thinking. Recently, the Austin American Statesman printed an article with the headline, "Officials Rethink Policy on Prisons." They are slowing down prison construction and considering going back to more parole time and shorter sentences. That is good news, but the current gravity of the situation still remains. Here's what has happened, is happening, and for the sake of simplicity, I'm going to focus mostly on the state of Texas. Texas has the largest prison system in the free world. If it were its own country, it would be incarcerating people at 7 times the rate of China. A decade ago, building prisons and making longer prison sentences was in vogue among policymakers. During a 5-year period, starting in 1991, Texas tripled the size of its prison system. During the Clinton administration, more people were incarcerated nationwide than both the Reagan and Bush Sr. administrations combined. Why were so many new prisons built? The factors that led to this prison boom appear to be related to the demands of a capitalist society. As more and more factories went overseas, and many of these factories being in rural areas, the only hope for these rural towns' survival was to build a prison, which created jobs and saved the local economies. It was also surmised that prisons could turn a corporate profit. But to build more prisons, you need more criminals. And you need to set up a tone of fear in society that supports the need to lock more people up. So a myth was created, that the United States was besieged on a scale never before encountered by a pathologically criminal underclass. Even though statistics pointed to the contrary, after spiraling upward during the drug wars, murder rates began falling in the mid-1990s, and they are lower today than they were 20 years ago. In some cities, they are lower than they were a century ago. So it was important to redefine what crimes would be deemed dangerous to society. There weren't enough violent crimes being committed to fill up the prisons, so lawmakers went after nonviolent offenders, usually drug-related cases, and made sentences much longer and the standards for convictions much more punitive. Now, the vast majority of policymakers, prosecutors, and judges do not like or support what has happened, and they are grappling with alternative solutions to retributive punishments. Like I said, this isn't anyone's fault. Yet, this is what has come to pass in our society. What has been created is a huge criminal underclass that once inside the system find it very difficult to get out. The system itself supports and generates this underclass. One of the obvious mistakes appears to be that people are being imprisoned who do not belong in prison. Numbers don't work well in a sermon, but I have to give you some, and then I will try to personalize this topic. I looked at many different sources of statistics, and what I have concluded is that Texas has roughly 700,000 of its citizens under criminal justice control. Of these, roughly 200,000 people are incarcerated behind bars, and the rest are on parole or probation. Of the 200,000 behind bars, 90,000 people, roughly half, are serving time for nonviolent crimes. While there are no surefire solutions to keeping drug offenders out of the system, at this point, rehabilitation and social programs do appear to be the best bet. As Carolyn pointed out, without access to rehab and social resources, drug addicts appear to be getting sicker. But that all seems obvious, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the obvious. More rehab is needed in place of prison time. What is much more important to draw attention to here are the racial realities of what has begun to be called the prison generation. Again, here are the facts. While the black population of Texas on the outside is 20%, the black prison population of Texas on the inside is around 70 to 80%. Blacks in Texas are incarcerated at 7 times the rate of whites. Now I'm heading into dangerous territory here when I run the risk of presenting blacks as victims of a racist society. I think it's important we take a time out here and admit to ourselves that nothing is so simple, and that to think of blacks as victims can be frightfully racist in itself. So, of course, there are a combination of things going on here that have landed so many young black men in Texas prisons. But nevertheless, we do have the facts to back up an unfair system. And we also have thousands of personal accounts, one of which you'll hear today. The fact is that the incarceration rate for blacks in Texas is 63% higher than the national average. Of course, poverty contributes equally to the unfairness. What researchers are saying is that we have reached a tipping point, that new arrests no longer reduce crime in poor black neighborhoods, but actually drive crime up. The reason, they say, is that arresting huge numbers of people so disrupts the social network that community ties crumble and therefore can no longer keep crime in check. So what is happening is a snowball effect. The very neighborhoods that such arrests were supposedly designed to protect are actually getting worse as a result of them. And these neighborhoods become breeding grounds for more crime. In the year 2000 issue of Newsweek, a special report about the prison system says this: even when such neighborhood dynamics are taken into account, many recent studies bolster the suspicion that there is a pervasive, fundamental, and race-based inequity in the system. The article goes on to say that white youths are much more likely than non-whites to be treated leniently in the criminal justice system. More black juveniles are sent to adult prisons than white juveniles. But here is a statistic that seems to really spell things out. Nearly 2/3 of offenders sent to state prison for drug offenses are black, while white drug users outnumber them by more than 5 to 1. There are 5 times as many white drug users as black drug users. Los Angeles civil rights attorney Connie Rice puts it this way. She says, "You can talk all you want about individual behavior, but we incarcerate poor kids for things that middle-class kids get counseling for. Middle-class kids also have access to good lawyers." So the point I'm trying to make here is that while it's true that there needs to be a higher degree of personal responsibility in the poor Black community, the system is at least equally at fault. The system does appear to be very classist and very racist. I interviewed one of Carolyn's volunteers, Lee Reese, for this sermon so I could share his story. Lee has been assisting Carolyn in her weekly group meetings for probationers for several months. Lee has a typical criminal record for a Black man who got caught up in the system. His first felony was in 1970 for marijuana possession, and in 1992, he was at the wrong place at the wrong time with a group of people who had one minuscule amount of crack among them. The cops raided this group, and since everyone else was going to go to jail on other unrelated charges, Lee got assigned as the one who had possession of this little bit of crack and was sentenced to 30 years. He spent 5 years in prison, and during that time lost the sight in his remaining good eye due to glaucoma that went undiagnosed. Because his sight was so bad, at one point he ran into a female guard by accident and was accused of assault, even though it was an accident, and he lost the good time he had earned as a result. Based on his experience, Lee has these perspectives on the criminal justice system. He believes that prison is a breeding bed to keep prejudice and bigotry alive, simply by the way it's all set up. In most prisons in Texas, which are primarily in rural areas, the guards are white and most of the prisoners Black. He says that Blacks are treated rougher than other prisoners by the guards and the wardens. Blacks are more likely to get solitary confinement, and there are more extreme measures taken on them. Of course, this exacerbates racial hatred on both ends. And while it's important to not cast Black people as victims, Lee contends that it is hard to not become a victim of the system. He says, "There's an East Austin in every major city in America. Once you're caught up in the system, it's very hard to get out because you have an X on your back. You don't learn any skills in jail about how to get by in society, and when you get out, you revert to old survival skills." Lee says that a lot of people wonder why young Black men are so angry. It's not just the prison experience. It's also the daily reminders that Black people are not accepted. Whether that's being stopped by cops for driving while Black, or when you hear the click of car doors being locked as you walk by a car full of white people, it is these daily reminders that not only are you not accepted, you are feared. And that really hurts. It hurts. But the machismo of our culture does not allow Black men to show this hurt, to express this pain, and so the deep hurt turns to anger. It completely erodes your spirit, Lee says. And he has a term for what is happening with this prison generation. He calls it soul genocide. When you take this many Black men out of society, they can't procreate healthy families. 70% of all Black men in this country have had some kind of confrontation with the law. And there's no money to fight back. There's no money for lawyers to sue for blatant harassment by the law. There's no status. Essentially, what is going on is that criminals have become the livelihood for rural towns in Texas. The longer the sentences, the more jobs there are for prison workers. One of Texas's greatest resources is its criminal population. Put crudely, they've become like animals to corral. It's the new farmers, the new farming of the 21st century, raising criminals. It used to be cotton. Is this the best our country can do? Do you see how especially the prison workers aren't on the outside anymore either? It's one thing for generations of a family to work at a mill or a factory, but now it's generations who work for a prison. And it's a system that depends on an underclass, on generating fear of this underclass. Fear is like a prison, and when this many people are scared, are fed on fear, no one is on the outside. No one is free. There's a lot of fear feeding going on these days, because fear is the easiest method of controlling people. I thought the best point made in Michael Moore's film Bowling for Columbine, and was certainly also made in his more recent 9/11 movie, that Americans are fed fear constantly, and so have very high levels of paranoia that they guard themselves against with very irrational methods, such as guns, such as locking people up who aren't a danger to anyone but themselves. I heard someone say recently that a democracy can't function without trust. And it seems that we've come to a point where many of our political and social institutions function through fear. Whether it's fear of terrorists or violent crimes or really anything, fear is like a prison. Lee got out of the system. It can be done. But he still has the X on his back. Even though he graduated magna cum laude from Austin Community College and is about to become a licensed chemical dependency counselor, he is still disadvantaged as an ex-con. He is carrying a torch for the ex-cons, for blacks, for ex-addicts, and for the blind. And he says, "I am trying to be self-sufficient. I want nothing more than to be accepted in conventional society." As I said at the beginning, there is hope for the system changing. There are things that can be done. If you're the kind of person who is politically inclined, you can urge your representatives in office to put more money into rehabilitation and social services than into prisons. The policymakers are currently discovering that incarceration is actually very expensive. That not only are alternatives more effective, but they are also cheaper for the state budget. Or if you're the kind of person who likes to get more personally involved, there are many ways to volunteer. Churches sponsor prison ministries. You can volunteer at halfway houses. You can be a mentor, either to an ex-con, a probationer, or a young child, especially if you plan on living in this community for the long term. But I have to admit that at this point in a sermon such as this one, I don't think that listing possible ways to help the situation is very compelling. What I would really like you to walk away with today is what I have said a few times, that no one is on the outside when this many people are on the inside. I've mentioned before that the greatest ill effect of modernity is isolation. Entire communities, especially poor from affluent, especially black from white, are very isolated from each other, even when they're only a few blocks apart. I don't think we can really find the desire and motivation within ourselves to volunteer or to become involved until we admit that it means taking us out of our comfort zones. At its core, building relationships with people and within situations that take us out of our comfort zones is an embodied act of defiance against the myth of fear, against the illusion of our separateness. I really believe that it's forming the unlikely relationships and friendships that will ultimately heal and rebuild our troubled society. We can only rebuild our trust again through relationship. Rather than thinking of it as combating injustice, which is such a loaded term and defined differently by many different kinds of social interests, think of it as defying isolation, as defying fear. Howard Thurman said, "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it." Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. What I would add to this and pose to you is that often we don't know what makes us come alive until we go do it. Often what makes us come alive is going into unknown territory, despite our fears. Often what makes us come alive is connecting with people we normally would not connect with. Often what makes us come alive is defying our own isolation, which begins on the inside.